ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
And this is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day, welcome to the program. My name's Fiona Broom. Lovely to have your company this Friday lunchtime. Well, the government's concerned, the red meat industry's disappointed by China's surprise new tariff on chilled and frozen Aussie beef.
Where you have a large buyer of our products, such as China, and they choose to do something that's highly inconsistent with their previous discussions and certainly our FTA, that does come to a shock to the industry.
You'll hear what the chair of Cattle Australia thinks about it all very soon. And a new tool has been developed to help seafood industries see into the future.
Depending on whether you're a fisherman or running an aquaculture business, you can decide how you're going to modify your business planning because a marine heatwave might be emerging.
More on that coming up. You'll also hear from the NT Fire and Emergency Services Commissioner on what's ahead in 2026. And plenty more. Stick around. The Northern Territory produces around one quarter of Australia's supply of melons. And this year is expected to be another big one for the melon industry. There's new markets opening up and some interesting new tech being trialled. Jonathan Davey from the industry group Melons Australia says nationally the industry grew in value last year and this year looks set to follow suit.
We as an industry are looking at things pretty positively. We had a 5% increase in terms of quantity of production, up to 276,000 tonnes, with a total value of an industry farm gate value at roughly $326 million, which is up from about $280-odd million the year before. Obviously, those positive stats are one way of looking at things. We're really concerned still with the fact that while the industry is growing and the value is growing, our returns to growers based on increased input costs, increase in the way of actually doing business is not seeing growers feel that in their back pocket. And really looking at how do we develop some strategies for 2026 and 27 around growing the returns for growers and looking at how we make sure they remain viable as an industry, we remain sustainable so that we continue providing fresh, healthy, local Australian melons for Australian consumers.
How are you planning to help return some of those price increases to growers?
Yeah, look, so we've got a fairly significant strategy that we'll work through kicking off in early 2026. Some of the key drivers behind that are going to be supporting market diversification, so looking at new markets overseas, doing some of the research and development to support those market access discussions and opening up of new markets. And I guess that in turn will allow us to work with our growers and broader supply chain around actually facilitating growers becoming price setters as opposed to continuing to be price takers and really working with them around how do we make sure that they are making enough money to be not just viable but also start to make a profit and then be able to return that investment into the industry so that we can continue to grow. We'll also look towards supporting innovation and adoption of technology and really starting to drive the industry forward.
Really interested to talk more about the technology, but let's go back to the markets. What are some of the things that are, I guess, presenting some sort of market barriers when you're talking about international markets at the moment? Is it biosecurity access issues or protocols there?
So it is protocols. Obviously, the three key markets that are within our target are South Korea, India, and Vietnam. all of whom are protocol markets, and therefore we require the necessary data sets and treatment protocols and pathways towards beginning those market access discussions. So we're really excited about trying to get that work kicked off in early 2026, and hopefully that then leads to us being able to have some discussions with both state and territory governments, federal governments, and international counterparts towards those markets being discussed as potential market access negotiations moving forward.
Melons is a pretty broad category. What are those countries interested in buying from Australia?
That is a really good question, and they're all different. So we have some of them who are after watermelon, others who are after the rock melon, honeydew, and other varieties. There's no one size fits all. So we'll work with those overseas countries in terms of what they're after and how do we make it possible for them to have access to our great fresh produce.
The melon market is growing in the Northern Territory. It's the Northern Territory's second largest horticultural industry now. Is technology playing a role in helping the sector to grow even further?
Look, it is, and there's some really great opportunities that are coming our way within the next 12 to 24 months. We just had a colleague from the United States out here who's developed one of the first mechanical harvesters for melons. The reason we had them out here was to work through what our crops look like, what are our conditions like in Australia, noting that the way that we look after our crop and the fruit and how we harvest it is really different to what they do in the US. And so bringing them out here to understand how we work and how our growers operate so that they can take that away and build that into their future strategies and plans. The Australian market is really appealing to a lot of these people because across the country we have 12 months of the year supply, and we're pretty much the only country in the world that can do that. So rather than machines sitting in a shed for 4 to 6 months of the year while seasons are changing, here we can move those machines around and allow for greater savings from our growers in terms of the investment and development within that space. So I think the next 12 to 24 months are going to become really, really exciting in terms of adoption of new technology, innovation, and that sort of moving away from everything being done by people. Obviously, that is addressing also workforce issues, which we're having in terms of the access for skilled and unskilled labour. And hopefully it also then works towards driving a return in the grower's pocket, as we talked about before, and continuing to increase the level of investment in RD&E and looking towards potential future initiatives around melon marketing, greater access for Australian consumers and international consumers with more product becoming available.
And that machine that will be trialled in Australia in 2026, can you describe it to me? Is it a robot body with some arms? Does it look a bit different to some of the pickers that are used in orchards?
So it looks very different to the pickers used in orchards. It's very similar to our current picking trailers where you have the bins on the back with a conveyor belt out the side. Normally we have our pickers walk along and they place the fruit onto the conveyor belt, which then gets taken onto the trailer and packed away. It actually has a suction and air-driven mechanical arms that come down and pick the melon up off the ground, put it onto the conveyor belt, and their version 2 and other versions that they're working on in terms of the ongoing development, we'll look at how they then take that melon once it hits the trailer and automatically pack it without actually having to have people on the trailer as well. So, look, for years we've talked about what mechanisation may well look like within the melon industry, and we've always struggled with the whole concept as to how it might look. Finally, we're starting to see something come about, and it's being now done in a way where we're not talking about full destruction of crops through just going along and having to take everything out, which was where previous models have been looking at. Obviously, we need to make sure that the product is handled and looked after in a way that it doesn't allow for any bruising or quality deterioration. So for us, it's about how do we make sure those fruit are looked after and cared for as best as possible, and really working through that with the developers of this technology in terms of what it may well look like in Australian conditions in the coming years.
And the international markets, as you say, there'll be a push in 2026 to move further into some of those international markets. But are melons being grown in Australia also being eaten by people in Australia?
So 99.9%, if as close as you can get to 100% of melons consumed in Australia are grown right here by Aussie farmers. Again, you know, we're continuing to see this level of growth, which is why we're looking at overseas markets so that we can continue to support the industry in terms of future growth aspirations. But we will still continue to make sure that our quality melons are provided here in Australia for Australian consumers, because the last thing we want to see is an increase in imports.
That's Jonathan Davey, the head of the industry group Melons Australia. So a big year ahead expected for the melon industry.
And this could get on. Sunday, join ABC Sport for the fifth Ashes Test between Australia and England. Hear every ball of the cricket all summer long.
The Ashes.
On your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
G'day, my name is Floyd. Yeah, I work in the Spanish mackerel fishery and in the Gulf of Carpentaria. I love what I do and love my job, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Angus in Alice Springs on the text line 0487 991 057. Angus says, China putting tariffs on Aussie beef may mean Aussies can put beef back on our plates. Thank you, China, says Angus. You'll hear from Cattle Australia in just a minute to hear what they make of this new tariff from China. But first, let's have a tune. Should Have Been a Cowboy. That Should Have Been a Cowboy from Toby Keith. It's a quarter to one here on the Country Hour. Fiona Broom with you this afternoon.
I like beef, so good to eat. Why, you can get your fill cooking on the grill, or with some like most is a big pot roast. I like beef.
So turning now to China's tariffs on Australia's chilled and frozen beef imports. Australia's agriculture minister says a more diversified export market will help Australia's beef industry deal with that new 55% tariff. The move to protect Chinese producers was announced yesterday. It's going to affect a number of countries, including Australia, Brazil, and Argentina. That tariff will kick in once Australia's beef exports hit 2.7 million metric tons this year. That amount is lower than the amount of beef that was sent to China in 2025. And Agriculture Minister Julie Collins says she's seriously concerned about the way China is applying what it's calling a safeguard mechanism.
Yeah, well, this is a global safeguard mechanism. We have been engaging together with industry, with Chinese officials, government and Chinese industry now for around a year in relation to how they would apply the safeguard measure. And, of course, this is a global safeguard measure. It's not just Australia that's been impacted here, but it will impact our industry because, of course, what was occurring was because of the good work of our government, a lot of the restrictions that were on our exports to China had been started to be lifted. And what has occurred is the way it's been averaged over 3 years is in the last 12 months, of course, our exports to China in terms of premium beef were increasing substantially. So
their argument really is Australia's selling it cheaper there than what they're selling it here, and that's how the dumping duties work. So they're going to apply a 55% tariff, not just to Australia, but to the world.
Globally, that's right. So what they've done is for all of their importers, they've done an average, and that what they've done is they've said, this is your average of what you're allowed to send into China, and then over that there will be a tariff apply. And we have been engaged for some time about the details of that, essentially, and what that might look like, and we've been working very closely with industry on this. We do have some serious concerns about the way it's applying, but we have not been singled out here.
The industry says it would cost us $1 billion if it stays how it is. there is a quota we can export to China to before these tariffs apply. Experts like Simon Quilty were saying sort of May, June is likely when that gets hit. Does that mean the government's on the clock? Do you need to start having better conversations with China to try and get a better deal before the middle of the year?
Well, as I said, we've already been working with industry and with governments making these representations already. We've made representations at the highest senior ministerial levels. We have been having government-to-government representations and industry-to-industry representations. We've all been working together here on Team Australia to make sure that Australian voices are heard. As I've said, they are applying this globally and they're applying it consistently. Our argument against that in terms of Australia is we are not a threat to their domestic industry, and we have a really high quality product that the Chinese market does want, and we want to continue to be able to export that. We also, of course, have been working with industry, as I said, to make sure that we do have other markets, and now our trade in terms of agriculture is the most diversified it has ever been. And what you saw also on the 1st of January this year was a whole range of tariffs on our agricultural trade lifted because of the good work of the government and industry working across the sector.
Not many of them, or none of them, are going to provide the billion that's lost here, though, yeah? And I've seen some media saying that this is going to bring beef prices down for Australians.
Well, there's been a lot of global displacement in terms of trade. As I said, Australia has been relatively shielded in the sense that we are more diversified than we have been. We saw, obviously, under the former government, the significant hit that Australia took in terms of our Chinese exports, $20 billion worth, and we've been slowly and steadily restoring that. We have been working really hard with industry and agriculture sectors to make sure that our trade is more diversified, and we're now the most diversified we have ever been in terms of our agriculture trade, to make sure that there are other markets available. And we'll continue to work, particularly with the beef industry, at that premium end, which is what we're talking about here, going into China to make sure that there are other markets available.
Yeah, and just in that answer, your government's been very vocal about rebuilding relationships with China post the COVID era trade war under the former government, though. But were you perhaps too overconfident in your diplomatic abilities, given that we're back here with tariffs on our beef to China?
Well, as I said, this is a global safeguard mechanism that's applying to all countries equally.
It's the same effect, though, isn't it, Minister?
Yeah. Well, essentially, part of the issue here is that the averaging of the 3-year period includes some of the time when we had those restrictions on. That's part of the issue here. And the way that it is being calculated. And that is, I guess, our concerns that we continue to raise with the government and with industry in China to see if we can't get some improvement in terms of our export quota limit there.
Yeah. Do you think Australia has a chance of negotiating a better deal than, say, some of the other countries affected by this over time, like you were able to do with tariffs on our beef to the USA?
Well, obviously, that also took some time, and this has been applied consistently globally. So we'll continue to put up our arguments and continue to work with industry, but we'll also continue to work with industry in terms of making sure that we have more markets available.
That's Australia's Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins, speaking there with Warwick Long.
I like beef, so good to eat. Why, you can get your fill cooking on the grill, or with some like most is a big pot roast. I like beef.
So Angus in Alice Springs reckons this tariff from China on exports, Aussie beef exports that go above a certain quota, that could mean that Aussie beef bound for China's markets could find its way onto Australian dinner tables instead. What do you reckon? 0487 991 0057 is the text number. Australia's peak cattle industry body says China's new tariff on Aussie beef products is disappointing. But just like the agriculture minister, Cattle Australia chair Gary Edwards says the industry will likely find new markets for beef that goes above China's quota. And Gary Edwards says ultimately it's going to be Chinese consumers that miss out.
Well, it's disappointing to see that a valued trading partner such as China has imposed what they've done today, particularly seeing Australia treated like other countries around the world that have massively increased their volumes. And it's just a disappointing result that the great relationship that we have hasn't seen us treated more appropriately. We've been treated as one of a bunch.
AMIC is wanting to push for an exemption. Is that something Cattle Australia would support?
Well, clearly, it's something that we've discussed with our contemporary red meat industry bodies that that we do expect, and we reasonably expect it to be treated differently to this, because the massive increase of beef imports that have gone into China over the last couple of years has really come from South America. This is really around what's the source and what's the problem here that's causing this issue for Chinese beef producers. And the issue is the massive amount of beef that's been redirected from South America that was traditionally going into the United States market, that as tariffs have been imposed on those countries and they've had reduced access, they've re-diverted massive volumes of beef and put it into China at very moderate pricing, which has obviously had an impact on that market. That's certainly not what Australia's done. Australia has continued to supply high-quality Australian beef at pricing that's consistent with the rest of our global contemporaries, and is really sought to continue to meet the demand of Chinese consumers for our very high-quality product.
What impact do you think this will have on Australia's red meat industry?
Well, fortunately, it's unlikely to have an impact for several months. The earliest potential impact may be around May, June, based off current volumes, but we'll wait and see. Hopefully that gives us time to engage in further discussions with our Chinese contemporaries and to hopefully moderate this position that we've seen imposed, because a 50% tariff imposition is a very blunt instrument, and that will very significantly disrupt trade if that is how it continues to roll out.
Does the Australian red meat industry need to improve its market diversification for when issues like this occur?
You know, Australia is fortunate that we have probably one of, if not the best, global market diversification in the world. And to be very fair, our red meat industry contemporaries such as AMIC and our service company in MLA does a great job of marketing our beef to in excess of 80 countries around the world. The challenge is where you have a large buyer of our product, such as China, and last year they took over 300,000 tonnes, and they choose to do something that's highly inconsistent with their previous discussions and certainly our FTA, that does come to a shock to the industry. It's very hard to say that we need more, because we've been doing a great job of getting that. It's just disappointing that the impact that's been caused from another part of the world is being applied to Australia, particularly when we have a very clear free trade agreement with China.
Do you know the types of product that go to China from the beef industry?
Well, there's an array of products that we send there, from, our lower cost, higher volume items, if you like, which is similar to the product that we send to the United States. But we're fortunate that there's big demand out of the US that will essentially swallow all of that up. But we also send a whole range of high quality, very well marbled product that goes into the restaurant system and in China. So China is a very diverse market. It's not a singular product situation, which is why it's traditionally been a great market for our country. But, ultimately we will see the trim and the lower end products probably go to other markets such as the US and other locations. The challenge will be where the additional volume that's been built up to service the China market goes for that high-end quality steaks and a lot of our grain-fed cattle that are focused on going to that China industry.
Have you heard from the federal government at all in regards to this situation?
Well, there's been an industry briefing by the federal government today, and obviously they've shared what they can in regards to the negotiations and ongoing discussions with China that we've all been involved in different capacities. The reality is there's not much they can do until there's a willingness from China, which will ultimately come from their consumers, about the impact that this has on the supply of product to their market. Having a generalist rule applied to beef like this is challenging, and it'll certainly be challenging for the Chinese market themselves to come to grips with it, because a significant point that once you breach a volume, it automatically triggers a 55% tariff is very hard for any business or any country to manage economically. So what we're going to see is probably a declining level of volume go to China, and there'll be less confidence in sending product to China as we start to approach that limit. That means that China is actually going to do itself a disservice in getting access to lower amounts of our high-quality beef protein.
That's Cuttle Australia Chair Gary Edwards speaking there with Megan Hughes.
Hey all you listeners, this is Barb from Darwin. I'm an underground truck driver at Tanami Gold Mine working with Newmont. You're listening to Country Hour. Be proud and be loud.
Thanks, Barb. You are listening to the Country Hour. Fiona Broom with you this afternoon. Just gone 5 minutes past one on your ABC. Over the next half hour, you'll find out how marine scientists have figured out how to see into the future.
Depending on whether you're a fisherman or running an aquaculture business, you can decide how you're going to modify your business planning because a marine heatwave might be emerging.
That story coming your way very soon. You'll also hear from the boss of the NT Fire and Emergency Services on what's ahead for 2026. Let's take a look at what's happening around the territory in the weather. Sally Cutter with you this afternoon. G'day, Sally.
Good afternoon.
I think there's been a bit of nice rain about the top end. Sally, what have the totals been like over the past 24 hours?
Oh, we have certainly had some fairly big ones. The Buller River's come in with 98 millimetres. That's their third highest January. So there's certainly been wet elsewhere out there. Saddle Creek, 85 millimetres. West Baines River, 68. Coolabah, 45. The Vic River Crossing, 42. There's still a bit of rain out in the Carpentaria. Merlin Mine had 40.2. But back over the western parts, East Baines, 37.5. And Timber Creek at the highway, Victoria Highway, 37.5. But we've had some pretty good rain so far today. And this is from 9 o'clock. The Fiona Station's had 58 millimetres. Waddy Creek's had 50.6 and Falsh Headland's 37.8. Doris Vale Crossing's 34, along with Mount Felix. So there's been, and they're 3 hour total. So there's some pretty good rainfall out there.
Yeah, that's a good amount over 3 hours. Yep. Is that rain going to continue, Sally, or is that going to ease off?
Well, we'll continue for another couple of days. And then as we go into next week, it possibly ease off. We've got ex Hayley just sitting over that southwest corner of the Daly district, and we had some heavy rainfall down there last night, as you can see from Buller River. But there's storms that are just moving across the southern Daly, around the Catherine catchment and Daly catchment and into Narnham Land at the moment. They're just south of Darwin, so Darwin's not been getting much, but there is showers streaming onto the coast, so to the north of that, and we are starting to see those showers starting to pop up and storms through Arnhem Land. And also there's actually a few showers down and storms down in the very far southwest corner of the Lassiter district as well.
Okay. What are temperatures looking like going into the weekend?
Going into the weekend, we're looking at some temperatures increasing, particularly down south. We got some very hot conditions developing in the Simpson and the Tanami, and as we go through next week, and even through the weekend, it's basically the Tanami, Lassiter, Simpson, and a little bit of the Gregory. So we're just seeing those above 40 degree temperatures, and it just sort of sits there for the next week. It's going up in the north. It's not quite so hot, but it's central Australia in the Tanami. It is certainly very hot down there.
So if you've got any outdoor work, mornings and evenings, I guess, Sally, over next week?
Yeah, that's probably the thing, because that's 40 degrees in the shade, don't forget. Yeah. And we will see the humidity increase down through the southern parts as we go through the latter part of the week. So that's going to make it feel hotter because you can't as efficiently cool yourself. And if you're out in the sun, it adds, I think, 6 to 8 degrees or something like that. So it's just be aware that just because it's sunny and it's not raining, it's still going to be very hot, which is going to cause a whole different set of issues.
Yes, yep, absolutely. So we don't have any warnings, flood warnings, I think, for the territory at the moment, Sally, but how are the rivers looking?
They're coming up and down, so the things are getting quite, so the the earth being a sponge is starting to fill up, so we are starting to get some runoff. So we are seeing some rivers, particularly up around the headwaters of the Catherine River into the Daly River as well. We're seeing rivers coming up. The 17 Mile Creek's rising, falling further downstream, but it's a new burst or pulse of water is going to be coming through the Catherine, and that's got to make its way eventually down through the Daly. We are, to this Borroloola, we're still seeing some rises, but not significant. They're 6.17 below the bridge at the moment, so they've got a fair bit of space there now. And the rivers are just coming up and down depending on exactly where the rain is and how heavy the rain's been.
Yeah. Just had another look at the Catherine River Camselli on the off chance that it's been fixed. It hasn't. It's still pointing sort of down at the barriers kind of thing, I think. That's a shame. I love the Catherine River Cam. Sally, anything that we need to know about marine winds as well at this time?
Okay, we are seeing those winds pick up a little bit. So right across the coast, the waters, the trough's moving a little bit further north. That's got the ex-cyclone in it. That's weakening out, but there is just a general increase in the winds across the coastal waters. I found the right wind. I've just got to find where the cursor is. So, okay, right. So we're looking at today on the west coast, the 15 to 20 knots, and it's going to be might ease off a little bit on Sunday, but that's mainly because the trough's moving north across that area. If you're out in the Arafura Sea, 10 to 15 knots today. Tomorrow, get it reaching up to 20 knots offshore east of Manangreta in the early morning, and then 15 to 20 knots across the waters tomorrow on Sunday. And if you're around in the Gulf of Carpentaria, similar, 10 to 15 today, but getting up to 10 to 15 tomorrow and then 15 to 20 on Sunday.
Yep. All right. So I guess the message, Sally, for the weekend is stay out of the heat and into next week where you can, and just drink lots of water, I guess.
Yep. If you're in the south, in the north, you probably also want to dodge some of that rain as well.
Yep. Sally, thanks for your time as always.
That's okay.
Sally Cutter at the Bureau of Meteorology there. And as you heard, it is heating up across the territory. It's heating up right across Australia. And the oceans are expected to warm up over the next few months as well. And now, for the first time, the Weather Bureau has a way of forecasting ocean heat waves and temperature rises months in advance. Alistair Hobday from the CSIRO has been collaborating with the Bureau of Meteorology to develop this new long-range marine forecast tool.
We can now look 4 months into the future, and that's a pretty amazing time period to be able to look ahead. You know well that if you're looking ahead at the weather, we trust a weather forecast about 3 to 7 days into the future. We're talking 4 months into the future here now.
So what has happened or gone in to create a modelling system that allows you to look that far ahead?
It's been a collaboration between CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology. And it's really the Bureau's underlying weather forecast model that's now got this in much higher resolution ocean in it, about 25 kilometres resolution, that's really improved our forecasting system.
How does that sort of compare to how far ahead you were able to look into marine heat waves previously?
Actually, we weren't able to look ahead at all at marine heat waves. So it really has been a four-year journey to get to this point. And it's only possible because of these high resolution, what we call coupled ocean atmosphere models.
Our 4 months, as you say, that is a long range, very long range forecast. So why are you able to see so far ahead in terms of what's happening in the waters as compared to the forecast that you're able to predict on land?
We typically say things like the ocean has a long memory, and it means that heat is retained for longer in the ocean than in the atmosphere. And you know how quickly we can transition from a hot day to a cold day on land. In the ocean, those transitions take a lot longer. And so once an ocean has got a push in a particular direction, it tends to maintain that push for a long period of time. And so our forecasting is our ability to look at where that push will end up 2, 3, 4 months into the future. And so when we see a patch of hot water today, or the conditions that will set up hot water, the model is able to then understand how the physics leads that area to remain warm or become warm 4 months in the future.
So does that give you a pretty high degree of confidence in the accuracy of that forecast, even though it is quite long, you know, perhaps with weather on land being so changeable, does that mean that this is more likely to be quite on the money?
Yeah, we do an evaluation called skill assessment, and that means looking at how the model has performed historically. For example, in January of 1990, how well did we forecast March of 1990, and so on. And that shows us that the forecasting ability varies around Australia, and it's also best only 1 month into the future, a little bit worse at 2 months, a little bit worse at 3 months, and at 4 months, it's still better than an average, but after that, it's not reliable. So we've trimmed these forecasts to be 4 months based on this historical assessment.
A lot of work has gone into this, but why? Why is it useful, and how is it useful to have to be able to forecast marine heat waves 4 months into the future?
Yeah, well, you know well that climate change is warming the oceans around Australia, and that's a long-term change. But on top of that long-term change, we have these very extreme events like marine heat waves that can lead to very dramatic changes in the ocean. And so they're much more rapid shocks, a bit like a cyclone on land compared to just a daily breeze. And so if you can look into the future, we can start to think about what we would do differently before this extreme event arrives. If you have information about the future, depending on whether you're a fisherman or running an aquaculture business or a tourism business, you can decide how you're going to modify your business planning because a marine heat wave might be emerging. So in aquaculture, you may decide to harvest your stock early, change the type of animal that you grow, change the feed mix that you provide for it, perhaps implement some disease management if warm waters lead to disease, and so on. In fisheries, there's a similarly long list of things you can do. And even in conservation, there are things like if its exposure to a heat wave is really dangerous for a species, you might decide to rescue it for a short period of time, remove it from the warm waters, and then pop it back in after the summer has passed.
I'm thinking of South Australia, for example. This year, of course, we've been impacted by quite an ongoing and lengthy harmful algal bloom, and the marine heat wave has been linked as you know, part of the factors into why we're seeing this. So would you know, this sort of modelling and having this kind of forecasting also help in perhaps flagging that another one of those might be on its way?
Not every marine heat wave leads to an algal bloom, but many algal blooms are associated with marine heat waves. And so this look in the future would let you decide to pay closer attention to the possibility of an algal bloom, definitely. Now, that might have sounded like a wishy-washy answer, so I'll just say again, yes, in general, information about the future heat of the ocean should let you understand algal blooms more.
Are there parts along the Australian coastline that there are flagging potential heat waves in the coming months?
Northeast Australia, where the Great Barrier Reef occurs, looks like being the area that's most at risk this summer. And that is an area that has shown up year after year as being a place where the ocean is warming quite rapidly. And so that extra warning will let coral reef managers decide where to do monitoring, perhaps where to do crown of thorns starfish culling, and for tourism operators to think about where they might participate in restoration activities or take tourists to see particularly pristine pieces of reef.
That's CSIRO research scientist Alistair Hobday speaking there with Selena Green. So I've just jumped online and I'm looking at the sea surface temperature anomaly map and looking ahead over the next few months, waters north of the NT are staying average throughout January, but by March it looks like they will be creeping up around 1 degree warmer than what is typical. 18 minutes past one, Fiona Brim with you on the Country Hour today. The Commissioner of the Northern Territory Fire and Emergency Services will be on your radio next with all the news for 2026 and a brand new award to announce. Now, back at the start of the wet season, Matt Brann asked for your wet season song suggestions, and we got a huge catalogue of song ideas that came through from you. And here's one from King Stingray. It's Cat 5 Cyclone.
But when I look into your eyes, I see a blue sky.
It's King Stingray with Cat 5. Fiona Broom with you on the Country Hour this afternoon. Nominations open today for a brand new award that's just been created by the Northern Territory Fire and Emergency Services. It's called the Women in Fire and Emergency Services Award. Commissioner Andy Wharton joins you now to tell you more about this award. Andy, historically, have women's contributions to the Territory's fire and emergency services been recognised?
Yes, they certainly have, and they've been recognised through a historic award called the Patricia Ann Brennan Award, and that supported the contribution of female employees and volunteers across the former tri-service, so police, fire and emergency services. So what happened is when we separated away from the police and we formed our own standalone agency, Northern Territory Fire and Emergency Services, we did a bit of an audit of the awards and accolades available to the agency and worked out that actually our members don't qualify anymore to apply for that particular award. So we created our own.
Tell me about this new award then.
Yes, so the new award is the Women in Fire and Emergency Services Award, and it's there to recognise an individual member, regardless of gender, I might add, who's made a significant contribution to women across the agency. So the criteria are similar to the other award, but they're tailored to our agency.
What are some of those criteria?
Look, it could be a range of things, demonstrating exceptional leadership, promoting gender equality and inclusion, providing outstanding support to women, leading or supporting meaningful initiatives. Really, it's anything that is going to make a long-term and sustainable positive impact on the workplace culture as it impacts women in our service.
Why is that something that you want to recognise? Why is that an important thing within the service?
Well, one of the things we spoke about when we moved away from police and had this great opportunity to create our own standalone agency was what sort of culture do we want? What sort of workplace culture do we want our people to operate in? Noting that a lot of the work that the agency does is really difficult anyway, why make it more difficult with workplace cultures that aren't supportive? And when I say supportive, not just supportive of women, supportive of diversity, supportive of every individual in the agency so that they can come to a place and work that they see and we see as an employer of choice.
What kind of roles do women occupy within the services?
Oh, we've got women performing critical roles at all levels right across the agency. We've got 30 female firefighters and we've got 66 women across our full-time establishment across the agencies. Everything from firefighting through to frontline volunteering through to leadership roles right across the agency. You know, we always want the agency as best as possible to represent the community that we serve. And so those roles are diverse and they're valued. I think it's very fair to say that females often bring a different perspective or a different approach, whether we're talking about solving critical, you know, problems as leaders or whether we're out there on the front line in a community, you know, talking to groups of people in the community. And this is, you know, diversity is not a throwaway word. This is real. This is real tangible benefits for an organisation when you have people that bring different ways of thinking or different ways of doing things to a group. That's what diversity is all about.
Andy Wharton, while we've got you, it's the 2nd of January. We've got a whole new year ahead of us. What's the plan for 2026?
Yeah, it's a really big year ahead for our agency. We've been operating now for about a year and a half as a standalone agency, and there's still a lot of the change process to go. And the change that's coming up is all geared towards building a safe and resilient Northern Territory. So this is where we look right across our organisation at the various service arms, so the Bushfires NT, the Northern Territory Emergency Service, the Northern Territory Fire and Rescue Service, and our corporate support service arm as well. We look at all of that and we say, how can we do things more efficiently? How can we deliver a better service? And how can we take this agency to the next level and position ourselves to be the emergency management agency for the Northern Territory?
Have you got any big plans on how you're going to achieve those goals in 2026?
Yeah, we absolutely do. A lot of last year was spent actually devising some of those plans, figuring out exactly where we're at, having a real deep dive, you know, into our financial management and the way that we're accountable for every cent we spend. And, of course, developing good leaders. That's going to be a real focus of this year too. I think something that we perhaps haven't done well in the past is to identify those second and third line leaders of the future and help develop and mentor them so that there's a plan, you know, when the current leaders eventually move on. And, you know, government's been really good at that. Last year, the OCPE commissioner ran some really good courses doing exactly that, and we had quite a few members on those as well, and we'll do the same this year.
Annie Wharton, Commissioner of the Northern Territory Fire and Emergency Services, thanks for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thanks very much.
And Happy New Year.
And to you.
Hi, my name's Jo. I'm from the Kilpinya Volunteer Fire Brigade, and you are listening to the Country Hour.
Many thanks to Andy Wharton for his time on the Country Hour today. So that new award, the Women in Fire and Emergency Services Award, that is open for nominations now. The NT Rural Women's Award, that's also open for nominations. There's still about a month to go for that one. I think nominations close on the 31st of January. So if you haven't got your application in for the NT Rural Women's Award, do go ahead and get working on it. You still have a few weeks left to apply for that. Did you know that 2026 has been declared the International Year of the Woman Farmer? It's a global campaign that's being run by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. They want to shine a spotlight on women's roles in agri-food systems around the world. So I'm sure we'll hear plenty on that, the International Year of the Woman Farmer, throughout the year. It's also the International Year of Rangelands and Pastoralists. That's another food and agriculture organization campaign this year, the International Year of Rangelands and Pastoralists. So lots going on for the NT in 2026. My name's Fiona Broom. Lovely to have had your company today. Must be time for me to get out of here. Keep it rural.